Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Chronic wasting disease is an illness that is fatal to deer. It is also very contagious, so when a deer is found to have contracted the disease, significant steps are taken to limit the movement of deer that may have been in contact with an infected animal, including quarantines. After years of CWD showing up in other states, deer in Pennsylvania have been diagnosed, including one recently at a deer farm in Lancaster County. We're going to be talking about chronic wasting disease and deer farms here in Pennsylvania with our guests today, Glenn Dice Jr. and Jared Berry. They both have deer farms, but are part of the Pennsylvania Deer Farmers Association. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I want to start with some of the basics. What is chronic wasting disease?
It's a neurological disorder specific to cervidae. It's deer, elk, or let me back up, white-tailed deer, elk, moose. It's in the same family as diseases as scrapie in sheep or BSE in cattle.
Or what many people would refer to as mad cow disease.
Correct, yes.
When you say a neurological disease, what does it do?
So essentially, it's a protein molecule that misfolds. We're not exactly sure why it misfolds. We don't have that answer yet. But somehow, the first one misfolds, and then it seduces a neighboring protein molecule to misfold as well.
Mm-hmm. So when a deer has presented itself with chronic wasting disease, what does it look like? What do you see?
Well, I've never personally seen a deer with chronic wasting disease in real life, only in pictures. It's not a disease of high prevalence in Pennsylvania. However, when you read the literature, they start to lose body weight. They become listless. Sometimes they're neurologically impaired, so they lose some of their mechanical ability. You know,
and stumbling around a little bit.
Yeah, I mean. I've never seen one, but that's what the literature says.
Jared, have you ever seen one?
No. Now, not to interrupt you, but there's symptoms that we've seen with pneumonia in our deer, and a lot of what you read with chronic wasting disease is some of those same symptoms we see with animals that have pneumonia or that may die of pneumonia or other illnesses, but I've never seen one with the disease.
As Glenn said, it is not a disease that is widespread here in Pennsylvania. I mean, the first case of it that was diagnosed was on a farm in 2012 in Adams County. Since then, there were about 100 free-ranging deer, and as I mentioned, this one recently on a farm in Lancaster County. So that is one of the reasons the two of you who have farms, been doing this for a long time, have never personally seen one. But what do you look for? I mean, this is something obviously with this coming to Pennsylvania, when you have deer on your farm, you have deer farms that you have to be looking for. What are you looking for? How do you know the difference between CWD and a deer that maybe has pneumonia?
Because we have to test for it. So if an animal dies on my farm, I am required to submit those samples to the Department of Agriculture under my testing protocol to test for chronic wasting disease. Every single deer over 12 months of age that dies on my farm has to be tested for CWD. No questions asked.
And you've been doing that I'm over 15 years doing that now.
Yeah, I'm just in the same boat, 12, 13 years.
So you were testing for CWD well before the first case was found here in Pennsylvania?
Yes.
Okay. So I also mentioned in the introduction that this is very contagious. How contagious?
The folks that I talk to would say that it's not a highly contagious disease. At least that's the literature that I've read. And again, that goes to that it's not a highly prevalent disease. The difficult part with CWD is that there's more questions than answers. Jared and I are fortunate because of the positions that we hold with the association. We get to go to DC and be in some meetings with, you know, some of our leading researchers. And the struggle with chronic wasting disease or prion diseases in general, we don't have enough answers. And that's the problem. Otherwise, we'd already have a live test figured out, or we'd have a vaccine figured out, or we'd have the genetic answer already figured out like they do in scrapie and sheep. We're simply not there in the Cervidae species yet.
What do you need? What do you need to help test it and diagnose it better?
Well, so we're, and I think if I understand where you're going, forgive me. But
yeah.
So some of the answers that we're looking for, I mean, I feel the most plausible solution moving forward is the answer that allows us to put it behind us and we no longer have to worry about it. And I look at the sheep industry for that. They were successful in identifying genetic markers and identifying basically in animals that were resistant to the disease. And in the scrape or in the sheep industry, they've been able to basically do away with about 90% of the scrapie in a decade. We're looking for similar answers in the deer world. We've been pursuing research and we've been successful in identifying less susceptible animals. We just haven't been able to identify the animal that's truly resistant yet, although that is ultimately our goal.
Can chronic wasting disease be spread to humans?
No, there's no evidence of that right now.
Even though it can be spread with bodily fluids?
Well, so the CDC says that there's no risk to basically a species jump. There's a robust species barrier. The CDC says that there's no risk for that, but they do advise not to eat meat from a positive animal.
Why is that?
Well, it's playing with fire. You know, why do that? Especially, they also have on the website that if the species barrier is ever to fail, it will be most likely because someone ate infected meat. And, you know, and I think about, you know, healthy people, if there's a robust species barrier, we probably don't have a problem. But if you look at a household where someone's on some sort of, they had chemotherapy and they already got a compromised immune system and then they eat something like that, that's just playing with fire. And I just don't think I personally don't think that's wise.
And this is something that can create some confusion or maybe at least some anxiety in hunters. A deer hunter out there that has taken a deer, comes up on that deer carcass, sees that the deer does not look healthy, may look at that and say, okay, I'm a little curious whether this deer is healthy. What do they do? Not with the Pennsylvania Game Commission or the Department of Agriculture, but
well,
what happens?
Me personally, as a hunter, if I were to give any advice to them, it's if the deer is not healthy, I would contact the Game Commission. You know, I would not consume that animal. If there's any concern otherwise, even with healthy animals, have it tested. Mm. You know, have it tested.
And where can you take it to be tested?
We take ours to the Department of Agriculture. I'm sure they could contact, hunters could contact Game Commission. They could direct them. All the samples go through the Department of Agriculture.
This is one area that is a little bit different in that it is not just the Pennsylvania Game Commission that has jurisdiction over this. They have jurisdiction over the hunting aspects of it, but the Department of Agriculture. I'm curious, Deer Farms, do you answer to the Department of Agriculture?
Yes, we're currently regulated by the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture.
Chronic wasting disease started off in western states. How did it get here to Pennsylvania?
No one knows that answer for sure. It was first diagnosed identified in mule deer in 1967, I think it was, at a Department of Natural Resources research facility. And since then, it's found its way into 23 different states, a couple of Canadian provinces. Regionally, it was first identified in West Virginia back in 2005, and then Virginia in 2009, Maryland 2010, and then ultimately discovered in Pennsylvania in the fall of 2012,
and that was on a deer farm in Adams County.
Well, it's important to note the first positive was actually identified in October of 2012 at an Adams County deer farm, but November, the very following month, it was found on three deer, hunter-harvested deer, in Bedford-Blair County area.
So it was mostly in western Pennsylvania.
Well, so the deer farm was in Adams County in, what, four counties away?
Right, right.
Approximately, they found it in three wild deer. And since then, you know, for us as deer farmers, how we stay in business is having healthy herds. That is the utmost priority. So it's imperative that we do our best to follow the guidelines of these health monitoring programs, and that's why our guys are so serious about it.
Well, go ahead. What are you saying?
No, it's important to note with the 2012 infections, the Adams County farm and the wild positives in Bedford Blair County with the tracebacks we can do with our record keeping in our farm deer, there was never a link found between the two. I'm sensitive to it. I don't know about Glenn, but when even in the startup of the of this radio interview, you know, we always hear it's first found in the captive, then spread to over 100 deer. Well, that's true, but the perception is not always the reality. I see it as two very different infections, and one in the wild, and then our Adams County situation, which at the end of the day was taken care of through a DMA1.
So you're yeah. like DMA1.
Sorry. Disease management area. So when the Adams County farm went detected a positive animal, the game commission came in and set up a what they call a disease management area around that farm.
Quarantine.
Well, what? No, Department of Ag had a quarantine on the farm.
Okay.
Game commission came in with a disease management area, and they could speak better to this, but they regionally. So they had a map, they drew boundaries around that farm. Generally, I think it's a 10-mile type of radius.
10-mile radius approximately.
And they did intensive, they came in and started doing surveillance on the outside of the fences on the wild deer to see if there was infection in the wild herd in that area. After 5 years of that intensive surveillance around those farms, there was no disease detected. And what I didn't note is that Adams County farm was depopulated, so there's no deer on that farm. Since 2012, in that area, there has been no disease found, and actually the Game Commission removed Disease Management Area 1 off their... It's no longer exists.
So just recently, though, I mentioned earlier this year, there was a deer that was infected found on a deer farm in northeastern Lancaster County. And the Game Commission responded in a similar way, and that they created a 10-mile area around that deer farm. And the Department of Agriculture quarantined that farm. So what does that mean? You talked a little bit about it, but with what the Game Commission did and what the Department of Agriculture did, what does that mean to the farm? What does that mean for hunters? What does that mean for even roadkill in that quarantine area?
So I can speak specifically to the Department of Agriculture because that's who we deal with all the time. As far as the farm that you're referencing, and it's true of all the farms, they are immediately quarantined through the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture under our program standards. And then there's what we refer to as an epidemiological assessment done on the farm to basically look at what disease risk may or may not be there, herd health assessment. And many times that leads to a euthanization of the herd, where the entire herd then is then depopulated, and it removes the live animal disease risk, and that's true of other facilities, and that's also true of what's going to happen in Lancaster County.
So let's talk about deer farms, because I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who are wondering just what a deer farm is. How do you define it? How do you explain it to people?
You want to take that one, Jared?
No, we laugh. It's exactly what it sounds like. You know, what's a cattle farm? What's a pig farm? What's a sheep farm? We're a deer farm. We raise deer, multiple different outlets for business, and our product is created through the raising of deer.
Okay, but what are those deer used for? Most people know what a pig is used for, a cattle farm, but how are deer that are raised on a farm, what are they used for?
So I'll speak for me personally, because it can vary based on the type of operation you have and the species that you choose to raise. I think it's important to note that in Pennsylvania, people probably think when you say a deer farm, they probably just think of white-tailed deer. But, you know, there's lots of other species that can or are raised in Pennsylvania and other states, such as elk or red deer, fallow deer, reindeer, sika deer. For me personally, I'm a whitetail guy. That's just where my love is. And so for me, I sorry about that. For me, I raise male breeding stock. I raise female breeding stock. I raise male hunting stock. I sell, in our world, it's called germ plasma or semen for breeding purposes. Antlers, hunting scents, if you're a reindeer guy, you're in the exhibition world. And then for me, the antlers have become a really big deal lately. They've gone from being something that was really just mainstream in the rural community or the hunting community. And now you know, antlers. You see them everywhere. I get calls for display windows for big stores. I sell antlers to hobbyists. I sell antlers to people that do what I never knew it existed, called flint napping.
Which is what?
They take a rock and they somehow mount it on the antler, and then they're making like arrowheads and that sort of stuff. And they use the antler to make the handle of the tool that they use. And I do the Pennsylvania Farm Show, and it's been rewarding to have all these people come to me and explain to me the different things they do and how they use antlers in their different activities.
So it is not just for hunting purposes.
Oh, my goodness, no. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness, no.
A big one, speaking of the farm show, and I know you get this a lot, and you missed it, but I'll just jump in, is venison. Sure. Venison production.
Sure.
A lot of our guys are raising fallow deer, red deer. A lot of those animals are used for venison production for restaurants, you know, that type of thing, or for sale to the public as well.
Let's take a phone call from Jim in Blainsport. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Scott.
Morning.
I live about a mile from the farm that just got closed, and I'm in that 10-mile radius. And I've hunted most of my life, and it just seems like the enclosure is not a natural habitat for a wild animal. I mean, I've hunted. I know what wild environments are, and you know, I'm really skeptical, and I don't think deer should be raised in that way. I mean, part of my question got answered. I understand the monetary reasons and everything, but as a hunting aesthetic and just as a Christian and a steward of the land, I don't think it's right.
Thank you very much for your call. I'm sure you have heard this criticism before, that these are wild animals and that they should be in the wild rather than being in an enclosed situation.
With me, there are wild counterparts to our animals. I consider my animals livestock, and same respect as I would have for any other animal. I don't know if there was a clear question there, but as far as a natural environment, this is a farming situation. There's no doubt about it. It's a livestock operation. If we're talking a larger piece of property that's managed for deer that utilizes our genetics, that's a whole different thing. But a breeding situation, a livestock farm, these animals are in many cases vaccinated, fed daily, fresh water. They are treated as good as any mm-hmm. livestock that I know of.
How you've touched on this, but how do your farms monitor for chronic wasting disease?
So in Pennsylvania, that's actually a really good point. So in Pennsylvania, 100% every deer farmer in the state has to be in a disease monitoring program. They're referred to as either HCP, which is a herd certification program, or HMP, a herd monitored program. Jared and I are both in HCPs. We test 100% of our deaths that die over 12 months of age, and we've been doing it, like I said, I've been doing it for more than 15 years. Pennsylvania is unique in the nature that we, as being leaders in the deer farming industry, helped to develop a protocol in our state where no deer farmers could be left out of that. In other states, deer farmers don't necessarily always have to be in a disease surveillance program. But in Pennsylvania, if you raise deer, you're required to be in one of two programs.
So this would seem, just from what you're describing, especially, you know, Jared, you said you're very sensitive to deer farms being accused of, if you will, and maybe I'm overstating it, of being the place where some of this disease has started. But it would seem to be difficult to get a handle on. I mean, yes, even if you're doing monitors on the farm, you not only have deer that are enclosed in enclosed pens. I don't know whether pen is the right word or not.
Makes sense for the conversation.
Okay. Yeah. How big? How much area does your herd have to wander?
So in my breeding herd, my breeding situation, my farm's just around 30 acres. And my paddocks, my pens, my sections, it's sectioned off into, you know, I might have females in this pen, males, yearlings in this pen, or two-year-old males, three, separated. And my acreage ranges anywhere from an acre and a half to 5 to 6 acre pastures.
Typically in the wild, how far does a white-tailed deer wander around?
I love to manage deer, and there's so much information out there on that. It can be as little as 50 to 100 acres on bigger mature deer to much more than that, especially during a rut when males are traveling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you see during a rut in a farm? Where do you manage that?
On a breeding farm situation?
Okay, breeding farm's one thing, but...
Oh, on the wild?
No, even on your farm. I mean, even those who are not breeders, I'm sure, get the urge.
Oh, yeah. As far as how do they act, I mean, there's the months of October, November, early December, there's a lot more activity in our pens, twofold. You know, they're our bucks are constantly on their feet. Let's put it that way.
What? Can I jump in?
Sure.
Okay. I want to go back and forth, but I want to go back to a question you asked earlier about chronic wasting disease and how you get a handle on it and those sort of things. I think it's important to point out because I like Jared, I am sensitive to the topic. In Pennsylvania at this point, there has been 8 locations in the deer farming community that have identified CWD. We, because of the program that we've chosen to be in, 8 of those have had all their deer killed. So the live animal risks there have all been removed. And for the caller that called in the farm and...
Let me jump in. 8 total.
I'm working there.
Okay.
Sorry.
I tell everybody be conversational. So this is just like a conversation. Thanks, guys.
So there was 8 total. Of those 8, 4 have had their animals depopulated. They've been killed. So the live animal risk there is removed. And then one more, the Lancaster County farm that the caller called in about, that farm is scheduled to be depopulated in the near future as well. So that actually takes it down to 3. And it is a sensitive topic for us because when we look at it comparatively speaking to the wild, and they have a difficult job, I'm not saying they don't, but they have over 100 different locations in the wild where they've identified CWD. And they don't have the benefit of a fence from keeping those other animals that were cohorts, that were co-mingling or grooming or feeding or breeding with their cohorts that had the disease for continuing to travel.
When you say they, Game Commission?
I'm sorry, PGC, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult task. I won't say it's not. But, you know, in our – the fence is a great tool. So we keep our animals inside our
To go a step further, when we talk about a quarantine situation or how to get a grasp on it, it goes more than just on that farm. If a positive is detected, there's a 5-year trace out. So any animals that left that farm, animals came into that farm, that all is done as part of the investigation of that farm. So those animals or those farms that have been linked are also shut down immediately. And there's increased surveillance or there's increased requirements out of those farms. Many cases, I've put down animals as part of quarantines to get off that quarantine to prove that that animal didn't have the disease. Many times it might be four or five years down the road that my animal's been on my farm, but I, in certain situations, I know of many farmers who have sacrificed animals to basically prove the disease is not on their farm so they can continue to operate.
Gentlemen, we're almost out of time for this portion of the program. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Glenn Dice Jr., Jared Barry, we're deer farmers in Pennsylvania and part of the Pennsylvania Deer Farmers Association. One final question. How do we get a handle on this disease, in your opinion?
Well, so I think that goes 2 different directions. I think how do you get a handle on it in the farm deer community in the wild? I do think, and I've gone to PGC and said I think there's areas where we can cooperatively work together, again, finding that genetic answer, because then we get to breed away from it similar to they did in Scrapie. And there's a benefit to the wild community there as well, because if we no longer have the disease, it benefits us. If they have to do relocation efforts like Iowa and Dane County of Wisconsin, where the disease has its highest prevalence, and they're saying there's potentially going to be population drawdowns. If you could identify animals with the genetic traits that the Game Commission could do relocation efforts of wild deer that wouldn't acquire the disease, it gives those hunters in those areas back their opportunity to stay afield. So I think there's areas for both of us. I think the answer is genetics.
I do. I agree with Glenn. I think it's important to note that I've heard Executive Director Brian Burhans from the Game Commission recently just say, and I tend to agree with him, this is not an issue that's going away in our lifetime. The disease will be here. It's here. In our world, research is our answer. More money, more research, better research. And I'm confident we will find those answers.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, and we're going to take a time out for just a moment because we are in the middle of WITF's spring fundraising campaign. I'm joined by WITF's Multimedia News Director, Tim Lambert. Tim, good morning.
Good morning, Scott, and what a morning it is. We hit the goal for Morning Edition, and we're making our way towards the goal for Smart Talk already. We haven't even just opened the mic for this pledge pitch, but we're already at $670 towards that goal of $1,000. So we hope that you enjoyed that conversation about WMD, chronic wasting disorder.
Right.
Yeah, I'm just that automatically.
You had weapons of mass destruction there.
Well, I guess in some cases it could be,
mass
destruction on some deer farms. But anyways, sorry for the slip up. But, you know, it's a conversation that gives you a little bit of insight into what deer farmers are going through, and into the disease itself, and some of the challenges facing. And so it's facing the region and the deer herd. So if you haven't if you didn't know a lot about CWD, then this was a good opportunity to find out
and
about it.
And that's what we're always trying to do on Smart Talk and WITF, is to put a highlight on some of those topics that people may not know a whole lot about.
Yeah, absolutely. And whether that's with the run-up to the election, we'll be profiling candidates coming up here over the next month, or whether it's an event that's happening in central Pennsylvania, Smart Talk is there for you. And we hope that if you listen to it every day, if you listen to it in the evening on the way home from work, if you listen to it at home, if you catch the podcast, that you'll make a contribution now in support of that of the program, whether it's $5 a month, whether it's $10 a month, maybe it's a one-time gift of $1 a day, maybe it's $30 a month. You can make that contribution at WITF.org or by calling 1-800-233-9483. That's WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483.
Yeah, variety is one of the most important things that we try to do with Smart Talk. I mean, again, it is not often that you get to hear a conversation about chronic wasting disease on deer farms
or WMDs,
or in the wild here in Pennsylvania. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking about some history here in Pennsylvania, and Tim. The two of us are big history buffs,
yes.
But so are WITF listeners. We know that this is one of the topics that you out there enjoy the most is history. I don't know how many times I hear from Smart Talk listeners, Tim, oh, do more shows on history. We love the history shows.
Well, it's not on the History Channel anymore, so
I guess this is
the place to
right.
do it. But history obviously is one of the issues that we try to highlight a lot. We bring on authors. We take you to historic places as part of the Smart Talk road trips that we do. And overall, really, WITF works to take you where the news is happening and bring issues to light to you and help you have a better understanding of your community. And if that's what you want out of a media organization, especially one that's locally owned and operated, which is a rarity in this day and age, you'll make that contribution right now, we hope, at WITF.org or 1-800-233-9483.
We have a goal of $1,000 during Smart Talk. We're on our way to that goal, but please put us over the top by going to 1-800-233-9483 or WITF.org/give now. Tim, we'll talk to you again in a few minutes.
Absolutely.
And I will make a point here, and I did this yesterday, I want to do it all week, because we've run into this in the past, that we have a couple 800 numbers here. Just gave you that 1-800-233-9483 number to contribute to WITF, become a member, because a member of the WITF family, the Smart Talk family. But here is the number, write it down, if you'd like to call in with a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. The State Museum of Pennsylvania is presenting a series of programs on the state's historic landscapes using the hand-drawn bird's-eye views of Pennsylvania cities and towns by Thaddeus Mortimer T.M. Fowler. The artist's work is featured in the exhibit Everything of Interest Shown, T.M. Fowler's Pennsylvania's Bird's-Eye Views, 1885 to 1905. It's currently on display at the museum and will be there for a month or so. And we'll talk more about just when you can see it, how you can see it, and some of the special programs around the museum. But joining us today, Beth Hager, who is director of the Pennsylvania State Museum. Beth, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for having us.
Also, Kurt Meyer, who is a senior curator at the State Museum. Kurt, good to see you again.
Likewise, Scott. Good morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF Sports Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Thaddeus Mortimer T.M. Fowler. Who was he, Kurt?
He's the probably the most prolific Pennsylvania artist that no one has ever heard of. He's a very interesting fellow. I describe him as being part of a very small fraternity of artists who made a living in the decades after the Civil War, traveling the United States and sketching townscapes across America. Small cities to and towns and villages to large cities. There were about 50 documented bird's eye view makers working across the country. T.M. Fowler was by far the most prolific, and we're very fortunate here in Pennsylvania that he chose Pennsylvania as his territory. Roughly between 1885 and 1905, he and his business partner James Moyer effectively set up shop in Pennsylvania and traveled the state and setting down in the regions and documenting the cities and towns that were at this point going through this amazing growth spurt because of industrialization and urbanization.
But when you say that he sat down and documented these landscapes, these cities and towns, he did it in a unique way. Almost everyone out there has seen a T.M. Fowler drawing. You look through a history book, especially about a city or a town, go to an antique store and you can find T.M. Fowler drawings. Describe them for someone who may say, oh, okay, now I know what you're talking about.
Right, right. It's very easy to conflate these bird's eye views with what were also called panoramic views, which the cities have been getting their portrait taken, if you will, forever. You can see, you know, from the Middle Ages up to the present, of course. But what was different about bird's eye views and what distinguished them from other earlier types of renderings of cities and towns is really the perspective. They're called bird's eye views because they are done from a perspective of 2,000 or 3,000 feet in the air. And they were intended to give viewers a sense of what a community would have looked like as if it was seen by a bird flying overhead, hence the name bird's eye views. What is remarkable about this genre is the way that they were executed. And because when you look at them, the first question people have is, how did the artist do that? This is remind people, visitors, what they should be aware of when they see our exhibit, which I hope they will come in to see this exhibit. It's up until May 6, runs through May 6. The first thing that, you know, they think about is, well, there must have been a hot air balloon that the artist must have gone up. And again, this is before aerial photography. It's well before Google Earth. And yet he did, T.M. Fowler and the other bird's eye view makers did not have access to a bluff or hillside. They didn't send a camera up with a pigeon in the air and take pictures that way.
No airplanes.
They had to use their imagination and hard work. All of these views were created by an artist who would arrive into a town or a city, get off the train. That was their form of transportation. That's how they reached all these places. And again, a reminder, in Pennsylvania, T.M. Fowler reached over 200 of these towns and cities. Which is a remarkable body of work to have captured through these bird's eye views. And then the artist would decamp for about a month and walk every single street in that given town or city.
So Google Earth before there was Google
Absolutely.
Earth. Absolutely. Before
their vehicles. And imagine what his tools was. He had a sketchbook, pen and pencil, and a magnifying glass. Magnifying glass was important because he walked the streets with his sketchbook. He rendered every building or feature that he saw in three dimensions. And then at night, back in his hotel room, because he wasn't working out of a studio, he was an itinerant artist who was decamping again for several weeks in a town, would then take that same drawing of that same building and draw it again in reduced scale and put it onto this view or this map that he created. And that is the hard work. And it took him roughly 4 to 6 weeks, depending on the size of the towns, to produce a single bird's eye view. After that, he just repeated the process and went to the next town. It was a really interesting business model, because if it ended there, we wouldn't have these wonderful views. But the reason why this worked is because after he created the view, his business partner, a fellow named James Moyer, who incidentally was a Pennsylvania native from Lebanon, would then walk the town again with the completed sketch and said, well, surely you would like to have one of these views, because your building, your place of worship, the place where you work is depicted. And that was how they built a customer base. Now, the end result of that for us is that because they were trying to sell these views, it was to their advantage to depict as many buildings and features as they could, because someone would have a connection to one of those buildings. So they're incredibly detailed and incredibly complete. And so for us, once those views were completed and he got a number of subscriptions, they sent them off to be published through lithography. And that's what we have left, these published lithographic views from which we then build our exhibit and which we have in the permanent collections of both the State Museum and the State Archives.
That is so fascinating. Beth, how did this exhibit come to be?
Well, we've been looking at our collections internally for a number of years, doing inventory and just really identifying the vast holdings that we have at the State Museum. And Kurt had come across inventorying these views, and we were looking at them, and we're all familiar with them. And there may have been an exhibit on them 30 years ago or something, or whenever they first were collected. And we thought, you know, this is really fresh today because of Google Earth and the interest in aerial photography, aerial views. And also, I have to say, I think that one of the one of the things that got us to do this, there's a Future City competition among middle schools in the area. It's a tremendous thing where kids do like these Sim City views mm-hmm. of towns, and they come to the museum. They've been doing this for 10 years. They have their competition at the State Museum every January, and we saw that last year. I'm like, this is a nice dovetail. So Kurt was working on the exhibit. We opened it, and then Future City came in. He gave the keynote. We are now displaying the Future City winners this year alongside the exhibit. It's just it has touched so much. Pennsylvania is so, geography is so important to Pennsylvania, and in the museum, whether it's the Pennsylvania Turnpike exhibit going from across the state, our Mammal Hall, we depict specific places. Pennsylvania and place and geography so important. So this just came right, dovetailed perfectly with it.
Why is this important, this exhibit, though, important to understand? Obviously, to understand Pennsylvania's history is one thing, but how does this exhibit, a lot of people, I'm sure, would look at a T.M. Fowler drawing or map and say, boy, that's neat. Let's see if I can find a place that I'm familiar with today mm-hmm. when this was written, this was drawn 100 years ago or over 100 years ago. But they may walk past it after they've looked at it. Why is it important today that we have these maps, we have these drawings, and what can they say to us today?
I'm only going to say one thing about it, because this exhibit is different than just a bunch of old prints on the wall. Kurt's interpretation and the research that he's done to detail the process, but also we have this fabulous interactive in the exhibit, which allows you to look at all of the views. We have about 30 on display. There's this wonderful big touch screen where you can go up and pull up everyone that was done of Pennsylvania and zoom in and see this wonderful detail. And we find that families, young kids are coming in, they go right for the interactive, of course, and they start to explore and look around, and then they're like, oh, this is on the wall. This is really interesting. I think it's something that's very personal to a lot of people. They come in, they remember, my grandmother was from Pottstown or wherever, and then they start to explore, and then they see other things in context. I think it's a good entry into history that maybe people don't even think of learning about a relative's place that it is history. So,
Kurt, there's a focus in the exhibit on Pennsylvania's industrial cities. Why?
Well, this was the period when Fowler was working between, in Pennsylvania between 1885 and 1905. But I have to remind listeners that he had a 53-year career. So he was, again, incredibly prolific, but he saw a lot. But industry shows up so strongly because people, it's easy to forget when, especially now, when Pennsylvania has become sort of the poster child for the Rust Belt, that really Pennsylvania was at the epicenter, I would say, of the second industrial revolution. We were the second largest state in the country by the late 19th century and into the early 20th century. And that was because of these strong regional industries that actually were national industries. Anthracite coal in northeastern Pennsylvania, lumber in the northern tier, and oil in the northern tier. Coal and glass and steel in southwestern Pennsylvania completely transformed the state and also transformed the nation. This was an incredibly important 20 or 30 year period. And it was these towns and cities that are still on the map and probably have diminished a bit since that high point. But it's really important to remember how strong Pennsylvania's industrial infrastructure was and the landscapes that they left behind that we still live with. Mm-hmm. You asked Beth that question, which she answered. I would also answer that and about the relevance of these, because these landscapes we continue to live with.
They remain.
And there's an infrastructure that I think people would be very surprised to see, even with places that they know. I look at these maps in some ways, and we have archaeologists on staff at the State Museum, and they do wonderful work. And I was teasing them a little bit about these views, and I said, well, this is archaeology without the dirt. I don't have to dig. This is you understand the layer of these places where we are right now. We start the show with this wonderful bird's eye view of Harrisburg. It's from 1881. And I've seen people approach that view, and they're kind of just become wide-eyed because they see things that have changed. At the same time, they see things that are the same.
Susquehanna River.
The Susquehanna River, the remnants of the Pennsylvania Canal, the railroads. All of these places are still there. They may have another layer over top of them, but they still define how our cities and towns work.
Speaking of layer over top of them, one of the programs that you have planned is using satellite imagery to go over top of a Fowler drawing. So I assume that satellite imagery from today and just put it over top. How's that going to work?
We have a fellow who's coming in. It's next Friday at part of our three-part Learn at Lunch series that is going to be taking place this final month of the exhibit. A fellow named John Hayden, who is really interested in showing how accurate, first of all, Fowler was in rendering these landscapes. But he's also interested in showing how you can overlay a Google Earth image and see precisely by comparing the Fowler view with the Google Earth view, what has changed and what's still there. And what he finds interesting in the work that he does is how a lot of these communities that now have brownfields, which are places where industry once existed, is no longer, don't really have a strong sense of what that was there and why it was there. And he's able to use Google Earth with Fowler to kind of give people a better sense of the connection between the past and the present.
You mentioned that's part of the lunch series. There are two others. What are they?
The first series, which we're kicking off actually this Friday, is again from our own agency, Brian Van Sweden and Shelby Splane, who are in our State Historic Preservation Office. We'll be talking about using Fowler views in their historic preservation work, the work that their office does in helping to recognize and document important historic buildings and historic resources that are out in communities. They use these views in their regular work, so they're going to be talking about historical architecture and underdocumented communities in Pennsylvania, such as the African American settlement in the late 19th century Pennsylvania towns and cities. Our last program coming from our state archives operation is going to be presented by Kurt Bell, who's our railroad historian, and he's going to be talking about using Fowler views to identify and document Pennsylvania's incredible railroad network in the late 19th century. Of course, we're home to the Pennsylvania Railroad, which at the time was the largest corporation, not only in the United States, but in the world. And they laid down these wonderful networks that we still have with us today.
I'm curious, as we wrap up this segment of the program, just from your observation, I don't know whether you could answer this or not. I may be catching you off guard. But looking at Fowler maps, drawings, bird's eye views, what city has changed the most and what city has stayed the same?
I thought I've thought about this in every possible way, but I've never thought of answering that particular type of question.
I'm always looking for different questions, Kurt.
That's a good one.
Yeah. You know, here's what I will say, and I'm being a politician, I'm not answering the question, but I will say what is remarkable with every one of these views is that there is a story in every one of these views. At first blush, they kind of all look the same because many of them have the same element. There's houses, there's always houses, there's churches, there's factories, and yet everyone is different. And it's the character of these towns that are I think really what people will be drawn to. They can see the character of these different regions forming that you find, for instance, bank barns in central Pennsylvania views. We still have bank barns today, but that's a piece of vernacular architecture that Fowler captured that is really part of our landscape here.
Fascinating. And it goes until May 6th to the exhibit at the State Museum of Pennsylvania, right?
Exactly. We're going to take a piece of it upstairs at some point to augment our industry and transportation gallery so you get to see it.
Beth Hager is the director of the Pennsylvania State Museum. Kurt Miner, senior curator at the State Museum. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Looking forward to seeing you next Tuesday, Scott.
That's
the Hansberry event.
That's right. And we're promoting that on WITF. I'll be part of that.
Excellent.
You're listening to WITF. Smart Talk on WITF, I should say. Your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We are in the midst of WITF's spring fundraising campaign. I'm joined by WITF's Multimedia News Director, Tim Lambert. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing well, Scott. Yourself?
I am doing very well.
Yeah, with temperatures creeping into the 70s, maybe by the end of the week and
Looking
the weekend.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, how about it? Maybe for the first time in a long time, I haven't said the word snow in the forecast, so that was fun this morning. But it is our annual spring fundraising campaign, having a little fun as we work towards that goal of $1,000 for Smart Talk this hour, and we hope to hear from you. We hope you enjoyed quite a divergence of topics today on Smart Talk, to say the least. It was enlightening to hear about the bird's eye view of the changing landscape of cities in Pennsylvania, and also to hear about some of the challenges facing the agriculture industry and the deer herd and the deer farmers in Pennsylvania with chronic wasting disease. So those are the kind of topics that you can hear on Smart Talk each and every day. And if you join us each and every day for Smart Talk, whether it's during the 9 o'clock hour or at 7 o'clock or on the podcast, we hope that you'll make a financial contribution to support the program and help keep it strong, help keep it going in central Pennsylvania. You can do it by going to WITF.org or calling 1-800-233-9483. Have you made a contribution of $5 a month or $10 a month or $30 a month or maybe a one-time gift of $1 a day, $365 to signify how often you listen to Smart Talk? You can go to WITF.org or call 1-800-233-9483.
You know, I just have to say, Tim, that you can tell that people are in a lot better mood because they're looking forward to the weather being a little bit warmer and actually being real spring. So we hope that translates into, you know, not that you look negatively on WITF, but even,
You get busy when it's nice outside.
Right.
You know,
right.
the first ray of sunshine on a weekend, everybody's out on the highways and you're wondering, where'd all this traffic come from? So now is the time to do it.
Yeah, before it gets to be 75 and sunny, now is the perfect time to call 1-800-233-9483 or go to WITF.
Which just happens to be the last day of our fun drive, by the way,
that's
Friday,
right,
when it's going to be 75.
That's so. Right. I mean,
no excuses. We're going to hit the goal.
We are looking forward to it. But, hey, I want to thank all our listeners out there, especially you Smart Talk listeners, loyal Smart Talk listeners, for your financial support today. But you are what makes it happen. You are the most important part of this program and everything we do on WITF. Tim, you know, we're involved in the community. Tonight, I'm moderating the debate of congressional candidates. You can't even list the number of things you've done outside the station here. But this is a way to be part of the community by your financial support. It translates into what we can do. Tim, thank you very much for being with us.
You got it, Scott.
Tomorrow is Holocaust Remembrance Day. We'll be talking about the Holocaust. Also, a discussion with author Patrick Sharkey, who will be in Harrisburg tomorrow night. His latest book is about the falling crime rate and what can be done to stay away from violence.